This is the Bigger Pockets Podcast, show 193.
I just feel like in today's market, because it is a landlord's market as far as that goes, you can rent properties very quickly here, and all you had to do is get...
You're listening to Bigger Pockets Radio, simplifying real estate for investors large and small. If you're here looking to learn about real estate investing without all the hype, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and be sure to join the millions of others who have benefited from BiggerPockets.com, your home for real estate investing online.
What's going on, everybody? This is Josh Dorkin, host of the Bigger Pockets Podcast, here with my co-host, Mr. Brandon Turner. What's up, man?
Not much. What are you up to?
I'm actually speaking later on today at the Denver Startup Week.
So those of you
listening, you know, we'll this will be a week old. But yeah, I'm going to speak on a panel about building your business, whether you should take money or bootstrap. And
fancy.
I, of course, bring in the yes, you should bootstrap angle.
Nice. And I heard you're going to meet the governor or something like that soon. That's fancy.
I don't know that I'm meeting the governor. I was invited to a dinner that the governor will be attending.
Josh, the big
I'm sure I am one of like, you know, 5,000 people there.
No, it's going to be like six of you at a Burger King. It's going to be amazing.
Well, now that would be fun. Like, you know, like, come on, that's cool. Like, you know, one of many, many hundreds or thousand. Yeah, whatever.
It's still an honor. Good job for being a big deal.
Thank you. I'm a whole big deal of nothing. But yeah, man, no, things are good. We got lots of cool stuff. We actually just brought on our graphic designer here at Bigger Pockets full time.
It's exciting.
And next week, we've got a new product designer coming on board. So lots happening. We still have a bunch of positions open at Bigger Pockets. And if you are looking for a job, check out biggerpockets.com/jobs. And you could find out what is currently available.
Even if you're not looking for a job, we would take you anyway. So biggerpockets.com/jobs.
I don't know about that.
Oh, I will still, right. I will steal good talent anywhere.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. How about you? What's cooking?
Same thing I do every night, Pinky. Trying to take over the world. What's that from?
G-Blaine.
Do you know what that's from?
Did I not just respond to?
You did. I didn't get what you said. Your accent was terrible.
Yes.
No, so I didn't think anybody knew what that was from.
So Pinky's accent. Okay, Blaine.
Yeah. Okay, so
that's Pinky and the Brain.
Yeah, yes. Pinky and the Brain. I love that.
One of my favorite little cartoons.
That's really funny that you knew that. I was actually I did not think you would know what that was from.
Oh,
I was even gonna like tease you for not knowing.
And the Brain.
Yeah, that was a great show. Anyway,
one is a genius. Oh wait, it's just like us.
It's just like us.
Others insane.
We
all
should.
Right.
We are
the, hey, Pinky.
We're Pinky. Yeah. Whatever. I don't think I'm Pinky. I think you're actually Pinky was the tall one, and Brain was the grumpy one. So I don't know. All right, moving on. Today's show is fantastic. I really, really, really like today's show. It was with a guy named Steve Garner. Steve got, I don't know, he's just doing really good stuff, buying single families, buying multifamily, got some really creative ways of finding deals. And towards the end of the show, we talk about his goal setting process. You guys are going to love this. Something I've never heard before. Really kind of actually like rocked my own world a little bit and like made me kind of rethink how I'm doing things. So check
all
that out.
All while working a full-time job, by the way.
All while working a full-time job. This guy's pretty legit, so you guys will love that. But speaking of goals, let's get to today's
quick tip.
All right, today's quick tip is, now, of course, depending on when you're listening to this, it could be different, but right now we are 3/4 of the way through the year. And so I want to encourage you guys.
What year is it?
We are in 2016.
Just making sure.
Yeah, when you get old, you start losing that. But anyway, I forget what year it is. But anyway, 2016, and my quick tip of the day is look back at your goals that you set January 1st, that you probably did, or early January. What did you have goal for this year? Look at where you're at and then adjust accordingly. Are you ahead of schedule on the number of properties you want to buy or the number of direct mail letters you want to send out or the number of, you know, connections you want to make? Whatever your goals were, evaluate.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah, get out there and do it because first off, if you're not doing that, why don't you sit down and start writing goals?
Yeah, set end of year goals for this year.
It's a great start. You know, what am I going to do in the last quarter of this year to help me accomplish what I'm trying to accomplish? If you're a newbie who's never done any real estate, maybe it's, you know, go look at 100 deals, evaluate 50 deals, you know, walk in the door on 25 deals and make an offer on one. Whatever it is, you know, track it, use the tools on Bigger Pockets, like our calculators and other stuff to help you out. But set those goals, create those goals, and then see where you are. And as Brandon said, you know, you make adjustments to ensure you're accomplishing what it is that you're trying to do. If you're not mapping, if you're not planning these things out, how are you going to get it done?
Yeah, you're just living reactively, and that's
exactly
not cool. So
exactly. Good. Oh my God, I can't talk. Good quick tip.
Passive income without the property headache? It's possible. There's a way to invest passively in real estate and get monthly income without any tenants, maintenance, or property management. The Wealthy have been doing this for years, and if you're an accredited or high net worth investor, you too can collect cash flow without the headaches that come from owning rentals. How? By investing in a private real estate fund with PPR Capital Management. PPR's co-founder Dave Van Horn wrote the book on real estate note investing for BP, but he's not just investing in notes. Dave and his team also have an extensive background in commercial real estate. And with PPR Capital Management, they're strategically investing in both notes and commercial real estate nationwide. With over $500 million in assets under management, PPR has provided individuals with a steady source of truly passive income since 2007 without ever missing a payment. Check them out at investwithppr.com. Again, if you're looking to get monthly passive income from an experienced team with a strong track record, go to investwithppr.com today. You might think you want real estate, but that's not true. What you really want is passive income. With new investors struggling to find deals or get enough money to buy them and veteran landlords tired of the constant tenant phone calls, is there a better alternative? Actually, there is. Short notes from ConnectInvest. ConnectInvest is an online investing platform that allows you to easily participate in passive real estate investing, and all you need is $500 to start. Short Notes collectively funds a diversified portfolio of commercial and residential real estate projects across acquisition, construction, and development phases. You'll earn a fixed monthly income without the hassle of owning or managing real estate. Head to connectinvest.com/BP to create your account. Fund your digital wallet with at least $500. Select from 6, 12, and 24-month short notes with annualized return rates up to 9%. Then sit back and let your monthly returns roll in. Join today by visiting connectinvest.com/VP. connectinvest.com/VP. You're ready to open a business bank account for your new property. You know what that means? Coordinating a time between you, your co-founders, and your bank consultant, waiting at the branch, or waiting for hours on the support line. Who has time for that? With Relay, you can open a business bank account for your property 100% online from anywhere. Create up to 20 accounts to organize money by property or by categories like expenses, taxes, or investments. Effortlessly collaborate with role-specific access. That means giving your cleaner a debit card for cleaning supplies or your accountant read-only access to your transactions. Own multiple businesses? Relay lets you open unlimited accounts and access them all from one centralized login. Okay, I'm going off script here. That is cool. It's annoying that I have to log into 10 business accounts with my current bank. So go sign up for RelayFi because that's a feature that I like. No monthly fees or minimums, and it takes just 10 minutes to sign up. Head on over to relayfi.com/biggerpockets for stress-free banking. You can join me because I'm heading on over there right now. I'm heading on over to relayfi.com/biggerpockets. Relay is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services provided by Thread Bank, member FDIC. The Relay Visa debit card is issued by Thread Bank pursuant to a license from Visa USA Inc. and may be used everywhere Visa debit cards are accepted.
Let's get to the guest. Do you want to introduce him?
Of course. All right, guys. Steve Garner. He's a real estate investor from North Carolina. Good guy working a full-time job that he loves and does not want to leave. And all the while, he's building up a really nice portfolio. I think he's at 19 or 20 units
yep.
at this point. And, you know, he's working, what do you say, about 10 hours a month
yeah.
on his business, which is great. I mean, it means that anybody can do it. If you say, I don't have the time, well, you know, you do.
You can do it.
Yeah, you can do it. So let's bring him in. Steve, welcome to the show, man. It's good to have you here.
Thanks a lot. I look forward to this.
Yeah, it should be fun. And I know, Steve, you listen to the show, right?
I listen to every one of the shows, and I've gone back and listened to all of them.
All right. Nice. That's good. So you know what's coming. You know the harassment you're about to get. Yeah, do apologize for that. So why don't we start with the question I like to begin with is, how did you get started with real estate?
I had always been interested in real estate, even back when I was in college. I still have my Carlton Sheets cassettes,
nice.
But I never did anything with it. I, you know, got out of college, went to work, and started putting money into 401k. So really what happened there is when the economy tanked, our company was looking to cut expenses everywhere possible, and they cut out doing the match on the 401k. So I thought that was a perfect opportunity for me to you know, set that money aside and start learning about real estate. And so started going to ARIA, found Bigger Pockets, started learning and saving during that year. And I got up the courage to buy a foreclosure and kind of caught the bug.
Cool.
What year was this, Steve?
It was 2009 is when the 2008 or 9 is when the company quit doing the 401k match. And when I would get paid, I would just have that same amount of money I had been putting aside directed to another account. So it just was piling up. In the meantime, I was started reading books, started going to the local RIA, and started listening to Bigger Pockets. So my first purchase was in November of 2010 after about a year of homework.
Okay.
Nice. So I've got a couple of questions. One, you talked about getting the courage to get into it and to get started. What was that like? You know, what did that require to build that courage up? And why were you able to do it where so many people who say they want to do it never get there?
I think it was just you got to have the education first that kind of helps remove some of the fear in my mind. And then, you know, and then you just have to take action. So that's kind of what I did. I had studied the market, you know, an area that I felt real comfortable with, and kept watching, you know, what homes were selling for, what homes were renting for. So I was real comfortable with the numbers, you know, with that. And so I just, you know, finally I just got up the courage to buy one, and it was a lot easier than I was expecting. And so, you know, my wife and I thought, you know, we'd always heard the horror stories about the bad tenants and the way they don't take care of things and pay late and call you all the time. And we just didn't experience that. We, you know, we bought the house, we fixed it up, we got it rented, and off we went. And so we just kept piling up that money from that rental, as well as, you know, the money we were saving anyway. We just didn't touch any of that. So we just wanted to continue to build. And, you know, it was a year after that we bought our second property.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nice. Nice. And really quickly, where are you? Where are you located?
I'm in Wilmington, North Carolina, which is, most people know where Myrtle Beach is. I'm 60 miles north of Myrtle Beach in North Carolina, Wrightsville Beach, Topsail Beach, Carolina Beach, that area.
Okay. Cool. And what's a typical purchase price look like in that area? Like maybe the first deal, what did you buy it for?
That's a good first deal I bought for $125,000. It was a foreclosure and needed a little bit of work, but not a lot.
Okay. And what did you end up getting it rented for at the beginning there?
I think I first rented it for $1,100.
Okay.
Yeah.
So roughly like a 1% deal. And then you were self-managing it, correct?
Correct. Yep. I was self-managing. And it really, all it needed is paint, and there was vinyl, you know, at the front doors and kitchen. And I had that replaced with tile. That's one of the things I do because I'm a long-term buy and hold investor. I try to rent proof them. I don't put carpet or vinyl. I tile and LVT, things that are going to last.
Yeah, that makes sense. I do more. I wish I could do more tile, but I live up in the Pacific Northwest, and like it's so abnormal to have tile anywhere that like there's nobody who does it. So like, you know, to get a tile guy, it's like $30 a square foot. So like, I just don't do a lot of it anymore. But anyway, I totally agree with that. Yeah, the more you can kind of tenant proof your property, make it indestructible, that helps. Right. It definitely helps a lot.
Hey, really quick, Steve, you said it was a foreclosure. So it sounds like it was an REO. Is that right?
Yes. Here and maybe everywhere, it seems like a lot of the REOs, what they were doing is they would go in and kind of lipstick them. They would put new carpet in and paint them, you know, but you had to pay attention because, you know, some of the faucets may not have been hooked up. They looked okay, but you still needed to go through them and look at it closely. And that's what this was. So it had been completely painted, had new carpet. They just didn't replace the vinyl, and it had spots and so forth on it. So
gotcha. For those people listening who don't know what an REO is, REO is a property that was foreclosed upon by the bank, and they basically, all the liens are clear, right? So you don't have to go to an auction and worry like, hey, is this property going to have some liens? Am I going to end up bidding on a property that is going to cost me more money? You know, what you pay for is what you pay for, right? You get what you pay for. I know they were doing some work on REOs across the country. A lot of folks were doing that to bring it to more of a state where you know, our buyer is going to come in and get it. So you picked this foreclosure up. Was that process complicated or was it pretty basic?
No, it was pretty basic. You know, it was listed with the agent. You know, I just riding by, saw the property. I called the agent that was, you know, that was on the sign. And fortunately, I mean, I recognized his name because he was part of the RIA group. And so I was a little bit familiar with him. But, you know, when I started going to RIA, I really didn't know that much. I was really just sitting back, listening and learning, not real active or involved. It was just learning. And so I knew who the person was on the sign, but really hadn't spent any time talking to him. And, you know, he not only is a, you know, agent, but he invests in property as well and has been real active in RIA for some time. So, yeah, but it was easy. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't like a short sale or anything like that. So,
sure. Right on. Sure. You know, you mentioned the RIA a couple times here. Can you explain to those people who have never heard that term, like, what is a RIA? And also, what are some tips for getting the most out of that?
RIA is your local real estate investors group, and most areas have one. And depending on where you are, it probably depends on, you know, the amount of people that show up. Ours meets once every month, second Thursday of the month. And just local people get together. I mean, some of them are flippers, some are buy and hold. You know, there's usually agents, real estate agents that attend. There'll be brokers that, you know, mortgage brokers that attend. And so it's just a place where you get together, and there'll be a topic once a month that you talk about, and you just learn from each other. And you help each other out, finding deals or cooperating on deals or selling deals to each other, that kind of thing.
So do you have any good tips for people who are, like, you know, maybe going to show up their first time? What should they bring? What should they do? What should they say and not say? How do they not get taken advantage of from somebody who's, you know, weird?
I would say, you know, bring a notebook to take notes. Don't be embarrassed to ask questions. You probably every month, half the people that show up are new people that have never done a deal in real estate. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, I've been there for 6 years. If you look around the room, you know, this past month, half of them still had probably never done a deal. But then you've got the other half that are active and are involved and are buying deals. And a lot of times people that are, you know, doing deals, they don't show up to every, you know, every meeting, but they're going to show up on a pretty regular basis, and you can get to know them and learn from them. And I mean, they're just a wealth of knowledge. I mean, it costs $100 a year to be a member, and just to be able to pick up the phone and find, you know, a contractor or something like that, you know, it more than pays for itself real quick.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I enjoy local real estate groups because it's a good place to, like, find, yeah, like you said, find local. I mean, hey, I need a contractor. Anybody got one? And people are like, yeah, I got this guy, John. He's great. Like, it's good for things like that. Yeah, people want to, like, find local real estate groups in their area. Just let people know. They can go to biggerpockets.com/events, EVENTS. And a lot of the real estate clubs around the country put their events there. And if you are listening to this and you go to a regular event, talk to whoever's in charge. Make sure that they're listing their event monthly or whenever it is on BiggerPockets events. I mean, there's thousands of people going there. So, I mean, we want to, as Bigger Pockets, we want to help take the online world to the real world and, you know, help people succeed in whatever way we can. So again, biggerpockets.com/events. So, all right. So what came after this first deal? You got this thing rented, you moved on, and you said a year later, you bought your second deal. What did that look like?
Yes. Actually, it's same neighborhood. It was right around the corner. This one happened to be on the Home Path program, which I think that program's still available, but I think it's kind of, seems like they're winding it down. That program, first-time home buyer, I think only has to put down like 3%, and there's no PMI, and I guess the government helps subsidize some of the things.
All right, so you were saying, Home Path program, which yeah, I know, like, I'm not a lender, but I know Home Path, like, it was a big thing, and they are winding it down. A lot of it's already shut down, I know. Like, and part of it, they're not doing anymore. Anyway, people can learn more about that. Just search Home Path on Bigger Pockets. You'll find some good stuff. But anyway, so you bought that property. What was that thing?
Yeah, that was a 3-2 right around the corner. I bought it for $134. I only had to put 10% down, $13,000 into it. And, you know, it cash flowed well. I think back then the interest rate, they do charge you about a 0.5% more interest rate. Back then the rate was, I think, 5.5%. Since then, I've refinanced it and brought the rate down, you know, to 4.5%. So it was a good deal to get into. Same kind of deal. They had gone in, new carpet, new paint. I think I had to replace the dishwasher, maybe put in a garage door opener, but it was very minimal.
What was it renting for? Do you know?
I think $1,150. So it's a little bit less than the 1% deal, maybe 0.8 or whatever. I guess the thing about it is it just didn't need any kind of, the roof is good, just didn't need any kind of repairs. And I kind of look at a cash on cash return. So I paid more for that one than I probably would pay today, but I was looking at the cash on cash return and not, you know, that was my main criteria at that point. I was still learning. So, and sure. I still am learning. So
what have you learned from that? I mean, like, you know, you said you paid for cash on cash return, but it sounds like you're doing it differently. Your criteria is a little different today. So what is different about your criteria?
Today, I'm looking for more equity in the deal up front. I realize, you know, there's even today, it's hard to find deals out there, but I want to have some equity, you know, more equity in the deal now than when I first started. So I think I'm lowering my offers and I'm making sure that I have a larger return at this point, just because of the unknowns. I mean, you know, I've been very fortunate. I've had a couple HVACs go out, and that's, you know, $4,000 to $5,000, yeah, to replace that. And so those are some big things that you should pay attention to. But that's probably been the biggest, you know, the biggest thing.
So. Hey Steve. So really quick, how many deals have you done so far?
Total of 11 deals. That nine single family homes, one condo, and then most recently I bought a 10 unit townhome.
Okay, yeah. I want to talk on that here in a minute, but before we do, I guess that's the size of your business. How are you finding, like, typically, how do you find deals that you've got so far?
It has been all over the board. It is, you know, driving neighborhoods. It is getting on some of the drips from the different agents. It is a little weird that you give them the same criteria, but certain things show up on different agents. And if they send me a deal, I go to them to make the offer. I've bought one from, you know, I was riding by one of my rentals or riding that neighborhood and I saw a for rent sign. And so I called the person and said, hey, you know, I've got a house in the neighborhood. Would you ever consider selling it? He goes, actually, me and my partner recently talked about selling that. And so I ended up buying the house from a, you know, for rent sign.
That's awesome. That's awesome. You know, some might tell people, like, on the Bigger Pockets webinar, there's been a few times where I've done this webinar talking about how to find deals. And I said, if you have no money at all, a very easy way to start finding deals, or at least talking to people, is like go on Craigslist or drive your neighborhood, look for for rent advertisements. So again, Craigslist, newspaper, or driving for dollars, and just driving around your neighborhood and call the landlords. I mean, at any given time, I'd probably guess 20% of landlords would be willing to sell if the price was right. And you also like get, I mean, they give you their phone number right there on the sign or in the Craigslist ad or whatever. So I think that's cool that worked for you and you got a deal that way. So
on the sign, you starting to come from North Carolina?
I pick up the accent of whoever I'm talking to. That's why I get like the angry New Yorker when I'm talking to you.
Oh, is that what's happening?
Yeah,
is
that exactly that. Yeah, when I talk, I get a little bit. I'm not going to try it.
Great strategy, by the way. I love it. Yeah, I don't think we had heard of anybody who had done that successfully. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. I love it.
Right. Yeah, the condo I got from the RIA group, you know, a guy mentioned he had a deal and nobody spoke up, and it seemed like a good deal. Came home that night, did the research, looked on the tax records, looked to see what things were renting for, and saw that it was a really good deal. So called him the next morning and I made an offer on that sight unseen. And he said, you know, I'd really like you to see it. But you know, I'll take some earnest money, and I'm glad I did, because within an hour, three other people at the RIA meeting had kind of waited to the next day to do their research and called about it, and I had already kind of spoken for it.
Oh, that's awesome!
That's cool.
Yeah. Hey, so you had talked about, you know, looking for more equity, and then you had actually mentioned having to do some HVAC work. You know, I think it's really important whenever that comes up to just mention and remind, especially the new people who are trying to calculate a deal, trying to calculate the numbers on a deal, on an opportunity, that you have to take that stuff into consideration up front. You know, unless you replace it today, and even if you do replace it today, you know, HVAC is going to have a usable life, and they don't make stuff like they did 50 years ago. Something, you know, my last house had the original HVAC from the 50s. And it probably won't need to be replaced for another 20, 30 years. I'm guessing that thing was solid. But today they're not as good. So you have to calculate that, right? Hey, over the lifeline of this property, we may have to replace it once or twice. The roof, things like that. Always account for those things because they will ding you, won't they?
Yes, they will. And, you know, I track not only the money that I, you know, I'm putting into these properties up front, but I look back and see how much I'm spending on average on, you know, repairs a year to help give me an accurate number to plug in for, you know, for CapEx. So over the 6 years, I know on each property I've averaged, you know, $100 a month. I've averaged $1,200 a year on CapEx in the 6 years that I've been doing it. You know, I put more money in on the front end. You know, I may average, you know, $7,000 on the front end, getting everything the way I want it. And then after that, usually that number is a lot lower. But you do have to plan on it. I've had a pipe burst that my deductible was $2,500, but, you know, it ends up costing you more than that out of pocket. So you just have to plan for those kind of things.
Yeah. On the $100 a month, was that, is that on average for properties that you're not putting the extra work upfront, or is that on the ones that you are actually?
What I did is I've kind of charted out on a spreadsheet, you know, every year what I spend on each property. And then so at the end of that, it gives me an average. But then I calculate that first year. The first year I always seems like on almost all of them, I'm spending, I guess the last one I bought, I spent $4,000 on, you know, some things there. The one before that, the one I bought from the, you know, the for rent sign, how that came about is he had let that property really get in bad shape. And I don't think he could find a renter because I put $15,000 into it. He would have had to probably put 8 or 9 really to get it into decent shape to rent it to a good tenant. I think he had it on Section 8 and, you know, cabinets needed to be replaced, and he had just let it run down. So for me, it's like if I put that in the estimate going in and know what my return's going to be, I'd prefer to do that because that's how you get the equity in the deal around here is it usually needs some kind of work. So most of them, other than the foreclosures, you know, that's the way I've bought them is you've had to do some kind of work to them.
Gotcha.
Makes sense. Fair enough. You know, the CapEx thing, I think, is an important discussion. You know, we've had it a few times on the podcast, but I think we should talk about it again. And Josh just mentioned this a second ago, and I'll just kind of reiterate. I mean, there are certain things like HVAC and others that are such an expense when they come up. And so people will buy property that's like, let's say it cash flows $100 a month. And they're like, yeah. Oh, great. I'm making $100 a month in cash flow.
Woo-hoo, yeah,
and then,
rich.
Yeah. 5 years down the road, they got a $10,000 bill for a new roof. And then 5 more years, they got a $10,000 bill for a new HVAC. And then 10 years later, they got new windows. And 10 years later, they got new plumbing. And so at the end of the day, properties are dead. They never make anything. And I have a couple of those properties. I mean, I've been there. I know what it's like, but it sucks. And so like, if you don't calculate and set aside money every month for those things, and I like usually between 100 and 200, you know, depending on the age of the property and how well I fixed it up to begin with. But I like to set that aside because yeah, it can turn what you thought was a good deal into just a money pit, I guess is the
right.
Yeah, terrible.
Well, and I will say this because I think the homes you're buying, Brandon, are a lot of all of mine are, I think all of them, but maybe one or two were built 95 or later.
That's cool. Yeah. All mine are like 1940 and earlier. So yeah.
I actually want to ask both of you guys this. So with putting aside that CapEx, are you guys including that as part of your quote reserves, or what are you just, you know, making sure you have that cash available? How are you actually accounting for putting that money aside? I guess I'll start with Steve.
That's a good question.
I make sure I have that money available to me. I'm not, okay. You know, I have all my security deposits set aside in a, you know, in a trust account. So,
sure.
So if I'm ever audited or whatever, that is set aside and, you know, it's not touched. The CapEx, I just want to make sure I have the cash or the credit available to where if something comes up, I can pay for it tomorrow. So, yeah, I'm not going to go out and spend all my reserves because I have to have that cushion.
Yeah. I'm actually probably pretty similar. Like, I don't necessarily take every month a chunk of my CapEx budget and put it aside, except for my partnerships. A lot of my partnerships I've worked with people, we actually do that because I want to make sure that if something ever went bad on the partnership, like, I wouldn't have to go to the partner and be like, hey, you know, there was this problem and we needed you to write me a check for $5,000. But on my own life, I'm like, okay, well, if something went wrong, I expect it so I can write a check for my own checking account if I had to. So, yeah, I'm kind of the same way.
Well, yeah. Well, let's continue on this line here. So sure. we're talking about CapEx and talking about reserves. Brandon, you said you calculate $100 to $200. Steve, you said it adds up to be about $100, give or take. What other reserves would people want to have cash available for?
I always just have, and I don't necessarily, I hate a lot of cash sitting in the bank, not doing anything. I want to either pay down debt with it or something like that. So for me, what I have a few different lines of credit that they're just non-secured. You go to the bank, but those also allow me to do, you know, if a deal pops up, I have the line of credit that I can use for that. I mean, I've gone to two different banks, and I think I may have heard one of your guests talk about it. I mean, the time to get credit is really when you don't need it.
Yeah.
So right now I don't need it, but I go there and I get a line. And if a deal pops up, I can just write a check for it, and then I pay that off pretty quickly. But I'm, you know, every month I'm using my cash flow. I'm setting that aside. I'm not touching kind of my investment income. So it's building up every month until I get the money to find a deal. But those lines of credit allow me to, you know, act if I run across something and I don't have the cash right then and there, or CapEx problem, a leak pops up or a HVAC goes out. I'm just not going to get that down on cash. I'd rather miss a deal than not have the money set aside. So.
Sure.
Fair enough. I have one more question on this line. Speaking of lines, this line of credit, do people have to go to the bank where their money is?
I just got that, by the way.
Get a line of credit. Yeah. Thank you.
Line. Hey, but
like, can you go to any bank, any local bank, and get a line of credit, or do you actually have to have cash or money with that bank?
You do not. They prefer you. You know, lots of times they'll say set up a checking account, but you can do that and put $25 in it or whatever. Yeah, I've got one line with Wells Fargo. I do some banking there, but my largest line of credit is with First Citizens, and that's the only account I have there, is just the line of credit. I borrow, and I will say this, I would say use it some. In fact, that's how I've gotten it increased. I ran across a deal. I had the cash to do it, but I used the line of credit. You know, it cost me a couple hundred dollars for a few months, and then I paid it off. But then when the line came up, you know, they renew it. I think it's a 2-year term. At the end of that 2 years, they say, do you want to renew this line of credit? And I always ask for an increase. So, you know, they've increased it a couple of times just because I have used it some.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great tip.
Yeah, that is a great tip. Cool. All right. Well, hey, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the multifamily, because you bought did you say 10 unit? Is that what it was?
Yeah, it's 10 unit townhomes. Yeah, it's two separate buildings that there's 6 units in one building, which I own that whole building. There's 6 units in the building beside it, and I got 4 of those. 2 of them are owned individually. So
interesting. So, I mean, did somebody before that just separate out 2 units and sell them as condos, basically?
Yes. I'll say that whole complex, there's probably 60 or 70 units total, you know, in this little townhome area. And the guy I bought them from, actually, he had bought these 10 out of foreclosure sometimes a few years ago. He had fixed up 5 of the 10 within that time period. And then it was being advertised as a multifamily with an 8 cap. And so I started looking at it and, you know, did some due diligence. And thing attracted me to it is I can break them up. And for what I paid for them, if I broke them up, you know, I'd have an instant profit if I just sold them off individually, or I could hold on to them and accept that monthly income. So I think there's several different, you know, for me, there's some value there that was kind of being overlooked.
And how did you find that property?
I had been talking with, we had a commercial real estate guy come in to local RIA and do a presentation. So I'd gotten his information. I had run into a situation where I was, you know, it was harder and harder to find residential deals. So I reached out to him and said, hey, if you run across any multifamilies or even commercial, he actually, you know, I was looking at buying a little strip center that had a Dollar General in it, but didn't like the location. So he was looking out for things for me and ran across this one, and it fit what I did. So.
That's cool. Nice. That's cool. Nice. So when he approached numbers? You with this, yeah, I'm going to know, like, what did you see in it? What made you excited? And then what did it look like numbers? What'd you buy it for?
Well, it was, like I said, eight cap. It was, I think it was listed for $975 or something like that. I ended up paying $885 for it. You know, when we got into the units, you know, some of them needed some repair. You know, I knew, you know, the five that he had fixed up, you know, were in good shape, brand new HVACs. You know, he did a good job fixing those up, but then there were five other ones. And so when the appraisal came in, you know, it was lower than what he was asking for. So, you know, I just went back and said, hey, the appraisal was what it is. And so he kind of accepted that, and the numbers worked. And so that's what we went with.
Okay, cool. And what did those units rent for?
At the time when I ran the numbers, they were averaging $875. When I'm putting new tenants into them, we're bumping it to $1,000.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And for those people who are confused when you say the word, what is an eight? Like, what's an eight cap? Can you explain? Like, and we don't have to get real deep into commercial, you know, valuations, but what do you mean by that?
Yeah, it takes your net operating income. So, you know, it's taking your gross rents minus all expenses, you know, divide that number by the value, and it comes up with a, you know, a percentage of return. And that's excluding any kind of mortgage or payment on the property.
Yeah. So it's kind of like saying, this is what the return on investment would be if you paid all cash for the property. Is that about right?
Yep.
So it's a good way of comparing between apples and oranges, because all commercial properties and multifamilies are so different. It's an easy way to say, hey, that's an 8.1, that's a 7, that's a 6, that's a 5, that's a 4, right?
Right. And that, see, again, that's what attracted me to it. So, you know, I ended up paying, each one of these units are 1,245 square feet. So they're pretty large units, 3-bedroom, 2-bath. And, you know, I bought for an average of $88.5. When I looked at them, individual units are selling for around $120 each. So, you know, I could break them up and make a profit just selling them off individually, or I could accept that monthly cash flow. So I felt like there was a, you know, some security going into it that way.
Yeah, kind of like you build some equity into it and you get the cash flow. It gives you lots of options for figuring out what to do. I love that.
Right. Well, and as you know, as you increase the rents, like I'm doing, I'm increasing the value of the property. So.
Yeah, that's one thing. I mean, that's why we love multifamily properties, is because, yeah, you increase the rent, you lower the expenses. Either way, your net operating income goes up, and the value, is that right? Yeah, it goes up, and so therefore the property value goes up. Yeah. And pretty cool stuff. All right. So how did you finance that property? Did you pay all cash or did you get a loan?
No, got a commercial loan from a local bank. And actually, it was easier than most of the residential properties. I mean, the paperwork is about half as much as what you do on a residential. They look at the deal itself. They look at what the income is. They look at what the expenses is. They make sure that your, you know, debt to income on that property is enough to cover until they're comfortable with it. And besides that, that's kind of it. I mean, they're not asking you for all these other, you know, your most recent bank statements or your most recent HOA dues or copies of all these leases and so forth. They just, you know, they look at the numbers, and if the numbers work, they'll lend you the money. If they don't work, then they're probably not going to lend you the money. You have to go somewhere else. So it's really all about the deal. I was surprised. You know, I kept expecting them, as we were getting closer and closer to closing, I was expecting them to call me and, you know, ask for something else, and they never did. But the residential properties, there's always a list of things you have to get them right before closing, your most recent, you know, check stubs and bank statements and whatever.
Blood drops.
Yeah, exactly. I've been turning down deals lately, like small, like single family houses and duplexes and stuff. Like, even though they were good deals, I just don't want to handle the paperwork that's going to be required to do a deal that's going to give me $100 a month. Like, I feel like I get so irritated with residential financing because they want everything that I've done the last 2 years, every bit of work I've done on properties. And yeah, like, it's like a colonoscopy. Like, they really dig into you. And
how's that feel, Brandon?
I'm still young. I don't have to do those yet. I don't know.
Yeah, they're not fun.
let's just I've done residential financing, so I think I have an idea. But anyway, no, I think
you make a small hand. Yeah.
I'm not that old yet either, Brandon.
So. Good. Well, yeah. All right. So I think you make a super valid point there. I mean, commercial lending can be a little bit easier, potentially less paperwork. I was also surprised when I got a refinance on my 24 unit. Same thing. It was like way less paperwork. So all right. Yeah. So let's shift gears one last section and talk about, before we move on to the fire round, managing your properties. Because it sounds like are you still self-managing everything?
I manage all the ones individual. The multi-unit, the townhomes, they were under property management when I bought them. And okay. As I looked at it, 6 of the 10 were going to be, the leases were going to be ending within 3 months of me buying them. I work full time. I've got a great job. I love what I do. And I knew I was going to be traveling during that time. So I left them, and they currently are. I still left them with property management. We're still kind of, I'll say, feeling ourselves out with that because for the most part, they do a good job. You know, when I did my walkthrough, one of the tenants really didn't take care of the property. So I informed them that when the lease was up to get her out and fix the place up, raise the rent and get somebody better in there. And that process, they knew the tenant would be leaving, but it took them 60 days to turn that property. So, you know, I've had a conversation with them. That is kind of unacceptable to me. I really believe I could have flipped it in 30 days knowing that she was going to be out. So I was not happy about that. But other than that, you know, everything else has been okay. So I'm kind of seeing, you know, Brandon and Heather got a great book on how to manage rental properties. And I've learned a lot from that. So I kind of have my systems in place, and I feel like I do a pretty good job with that. So my expectations for property management are probably higher than most.
Well, as thanks, Steve.
As they should be. Hey, yeah. Steve. So, you know, talk about that. How does somebody know whether or not they found a good property manager? I know this is your first experience, but like, you know, what should they have done? What did you expect of them? I guess.
Well, I guess I think about how I would have, you know, I think about how I would have managed it. I knew the tenant would be leaving. I would have arranged, you know, I would have made sure I had the painter on the schedule, the flooring company, because all the flooring needed to be replaced. I would have had appliances picked out or, you know, whatever. And I just think, you know, once they're out, I know they're out at the end of the month, you know, I would have had the, you know, the trades go in right behind it. I understand. And there were a few unexpected things when the tile guy was in there doing the tile. He said, hey, you need a plumber because, you know, the valves are leaking or whatever. But usually you can get a plumber, you know, pretty quickly in there to go through that one unit. And, you know, and so I just feel like in today's market, because it is a landlord's market, as far as that goes, you can rent properties very quickly here. And all you had to do is get it fixed up. And that's where I feel like they drag their feet is, you know, some of these contractors are busy, but knowing the tenant was leaving, I would have expected them to have that lined up.
Yeah, sure.
I found that like no property manager I've dealt with is ever proactive. I feel like they're all reactive. It's like, oh, now the tenant's out. Now we better start working on this. And like, I don't know how you train somebody to be proactive.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm really in the feeling out stages. I mean, you know, I really don't spend a lot of time on the properties that I have. The most time I spend is when a tenant leaves and doing that turnover. And really, you know, I've got one that's leaving at the end of this month, and I advertised it last week. I got a, you know, deposit to hold, you know, the thing I learned from Brandon, got that yesterday. So I've got it rented. Nice. And the old tenant is still in there to the end of this month, but I've got a new tenant lined up to go in right behind them. And so, you know, I would think that that's what they do all the time, that they would be as good at it as I am, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. How many hours a week do you spend on your business? You said you don't spend too much time.
It just it's so inconsistent. I don't know. It's probably only maybe 10 hours a month, but most of that is just tenant texts and, you know, says that, yeah, I don't know, the toilet isn't working correctly. And so I text my repair guy saying, hey, contact this tenant. I've been very fortunate to find good contractors that contact the tenant immediately is probably the number one thing, to let them know, hey, somebody is, you know, is on it. And so I just ask him to contact him immediately and schedule a time to go fix it. So that's kind of it. It's probably more paying bills. And I've heard Brandon say it, you know, dealing with, you know, insurance errors or things like that. I mean, all the paper that comes, you know, you can set mortgage payments and insurance payments and all those different things to do auto pay on bill pay. It's just matching all those things up probably takes more time than anything else.
Right on. And lastly, what you said, you love what you do for a living. You work full time. What do you actually do?
I work for a flooring distributor. We sell to like the local flooring stores, mostly hardwood, but then also laminate and LVT. Wood products are products that look like wood flooring.
So you're telling me that you work at a flooring company, love your job, and on top of that, you're running a rental business with 19 units. That's pretty good.
Yeah, like I said, it's from the beginning, it's been easier than I expected. I mean, you know, for all these years, I kicked myself for not doing something when I was a lot younger. So I'd be in a lot different position than I am now. So,
yeah. You know, what you said there, I think was so true for me and so true for most people I know who ultimately jump into becoming a landlord. It is generally easier than people think. Like, I think there's like this in our culture, there's this fear of being a landlord in the middle of the night, phone calls and the tenants and the toilets and all this stuff. But like, those are the stories that we tell at a party because they're funny. They're not the day-to-day, you know, drama that we deal with. Like, being a landlord isn't actually that difficult, I feel, especially when you have systems set up, when you just run your business the right way. I don't think it's too difficult.
I think screening your tenants and having a, you know, a standard that you're going to go by, you know, it helps you avoid so much down the road.
That's so true.
So, yeah, I mean, you do get a lot of, you know, people that aren't qualified or that they won't get approved through a process. So, you know, they do seek out, I'll say, individual owners that are renting properties that don't run it like a business. And so you just have to, you know, I put in my, you know, FICO score of 600 is a minimum. So, you know, I put that in the ad. And I think that probably deters some people from even responding, but still, I still get, you know, a good percentage that say, well, my credit score is not that good, but would you consider me anyway? And, you know, just unfortunately you got to say no. And there's so many good tenants out there that you want to make sure you find that good tenant and check the references, call their previous landlords, I always call their employers, make sure they're going to have a job in a year or two or whatever. And so, you know, do the homework. And that's what I said. The turnover is where I spend more time. Fortunately, you don't get the turnover if you take care of problems. You know, most of my tenants have only left really to go buy their own home. So
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, so many good tips right in there. We could probably do a whole show just on how you manage your properties, but you're doing an awesome job at it. Yeah. And if people want to know more about managing properties, you mentioned it earlier, Steve, so I'll plug it here. You can get the book on managing rental properties at biggerpockets.com/rentalbook or /bookstore or get it on Amazon. And my wife and I wrote that together. So anyway,
shameless plugging.
I gotta congratulate my wife. She wrote most of that book and she is
a rock star.
Good job, Heather.
Nicely done.
Yeah, she runs a tight ship here. So cool. Nice.
Shall we?
We shall. Let's move on to the world famous fire round.
It's time for the fire round.
Whether you need to buy or sell, or you're just obsessed with looking at homes for sale, Redfin's got you covered. Redfin updates their listings every 2 minutes to help you see new homes first. And they give you personalized recommendations based on the homes you like, so you can find a home that's just right for you, whether that's a cabin, a craftsman, or a castle. With the top-rated Redfin app, you can favorite homes, share listings with others, and schedule tours even on the same day with a local Redfin agent who can help guide you through the whole home buying process. And if you're looking to sell, Redfin agents have the experience to help you get the best price possible for your home. That's because they sell twice as many homes as other agents. With a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin's fees are half of what others often charge, which means you'll have more money to put towards what matters most to you, like your next home. In fact, last year, Redfin saved home sellers $127 million. No matter where you are in your real estate journey, Redfin can help. Download the Redfin app to get started today. We're always looking for ways to improve, searching for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for better is by matching with quality candidates. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BiggerPockets. Just go to Indeed.com/BiggerPockets right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Indeed.com/BiggerPockets. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Listen up, business owners, because I've got some quick little math for you. Fewer costs equal more profit. The problem? You're spending more than ever on operations, materials, deliveries, software, and more. So why not reduce your costs and headaches with NetSuite by Oracle? NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Oh, also, NetSuite lives in the cloud, which means you can reduce IT costs with no hardware required. Cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because now you've got one unified business management suite. You can improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. It makes sense that over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. So don't let rising costs sink your business growth. And by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/biggerpockets. 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 This show is sponsored by Airbnb. Did you know that a long time ago, before I ever started my real estate business, I turned one of my first primary residences into an Airbnb? And that's the extra income that I needed from Airbnb that gave me the confidence to go out and work for myself and eventually quit my 9-to-5 job. And now I have dozens of Airbnbs all over the country. I've even partnered up with the old David Green on a recent property in Scottsdale to take our portfolio to the next level. And of course, we host it on Airbnb. But you don't need to be a full-time real estate investor to start on Airbnb. As a matter of fact, I was self-managing 10 properties while working my 9-to-5 job, so I know anybody can do it. Think about it this way. You're looking for extra income and going on a vacation. Wouldn't it be great to rent out your space and let your property pay for itself while you're gone? I did this one time. I pitched my wife and my roommate, because we were house hacking, on the idea of renting out our home, and it paid for all of our expenses on a trip to Mexico City. So go and give it a try. It might just change your life, just like it did mine. And I really do mean that. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
All right, the fire round. These questions come direct out of the Bigger Pockets forums, and we're going to fire them right at you, Steve.
Where do they come from?
The Bigger Pockets forums, which you can get at biggerpockets.com/forums.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's really a cool place, Josh. You should check it out sometime.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really neat. Like, this guy invented it like a dozen years ago, and it's helped a lot of people. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, check it out, guys. There's like thousands of posts a day added there, people linking up.
Yes. All right. So these are some of the questions that people have asked. So let's see what you got to say, Steve. Number one, is there anything specific that you do to make sure you reach your goals and that their goals will motivate you? Like, what do you do for your goal setting in your life?
This is a big one for me, and I've always been a goal setter. Me and my wife, we not only set individual goals, but we kind of meet together at least usually around the first of the year, and I'll share my goals with her, and she'll share hers with me, and so we try to help each other meet those, because sometimes they, to a certain degree, can contradict. I mean, I may want to buy property, and one of her goals may be to pay down debt, and so it's a perfect time to talk about that. And then I think you have to keep them in front of you. I mean, I post mine. I've got them taped to the back of my phone. I've got them taped to my dashboard. I've got them taped on the front of my computer. So my goals are always in front of me. So it helps motivate me to, I'm going to say, almost create some self-accountability to move towards those goals. So I would say keep them in front of you, set them, and evaluate them and track them.
I love that. Yeah.
That was great.
The phone thing, that's kind of a cool idea. Put it on the back of your phone, tape it to that. That's cool. I also love that you mentioned the spouse thing because, I mean, so many of us, a lot of real estate investors are very A-type personality. We just jump in, we do things, we got goals, and we kind of forget that our spouse may have completely opposite goals. I mean, I think you might be the first of 180 guests to bring up the fact that your goals may be completely contradictory to your spouse's, and you got to work that out. Otherwise, you just steamroll right over them and... I know. Now it makes me really think I got to go talk to Heather. Make sure we're on the same page here.
You guys need counseling.
No, no, but my wife and I do the same thing. And I think you did it too, Josh, right? Go out, beginning of the year, go out with your spouse, work through your goals, figure out what do you want for the coming year.
Yeah. And then we have a notebook. We keep a notebook and it fluctuates where it is, but it's usually a very visible place. And we keep flipping, you know, every couple of days we're looking at it and making sure we're making progress on some of those things. So, you know, pen and paper seems to work for us.
Yeah, cool. Do you have any advice on raising your kids to be financially savvy?
One of the things I heard as far as like raising your kids, and I did it with my daughter. My daughter's 27 now, so she's grown and living in New York. But I guess this is just a short story. And I think it was maybe John Maxwell that told it. But he said is when he was growing up, he went over to a buddy's house. You know, he's 10 years old and his buddy is, you know, wants to go out and play. And his dad says, hey, you need to take out the trash, clean your room or whatever to get your allowance. And so, John realized, hey, you know, my parents don't pay me an allowance to take out the trash or make up my room, that kind of thing. So he went home and asked his dad, said, hey, you know, Johnny gets paid to take out the trash. You know, why don't you pay, you know, me and my brother to take out the trash? He said, well, if I wanted you to grow up to be a trash man, I'd pay you to take out the trash. And so what he did is he paid his kids to read books. So like my daughter, when growing up, I would pay her to read, you know, Richest Man in Babylon, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, you know, How to Win Friends, Influence People. So when she wanted money to go to the movies or to buy something, that kind of thing, I would just give her a book. And so even now at 27, you know, she'll buy books like that and give to her friends because they may not know how to manage money or know how to do different things. But it served me well in learning that early on to hand her books and allow her to fill her mind with things that would help her later on in life.
That's awesome. I love that. Yeah, I love that. Great. I'm going to totally steal that idea.
I might steal it too. All right, next question in the fire round. What have you learned is the best way to collect rent from your tenants?
Because my work causes me to travel quite often. In the beginning, you know, I'd have them mail me rent or that kind of thing. But you know, I'd be gone for a week and I'd get home and then I'd have to, you know, try to get them to the bank. Now I set up a rental account at a, you know, usually at a bank close to the neighborhood, and I have the tenants. They deposit the rents, but every rent is set differently. So I don't have two rents that are $1,100. I may have one that's $1,103. I may have one that's $1,098.
Yeah.
So when and I get alerts, text alerts. So when the deposit is made, I get an immediate alert saying this amount was paid. And then I can go in on my phone or when I get home or whatever, and then I move that money. The bank has told me that there's no way that a tenant could withdraw that money. But when, you know, 20 different people have an account number, I don't feel comfortable with that. So I leave $25 in that account. When I get the text, I go in and move it to an account they don't know. So
that's clever. I like the different rental amounts. That's kind of cool. Well, I mean, I don't know how scalable it is when you have hundreds and hundreds of units.
700 units. Oh, that was $1,147. Oh, okay. Yeah, that was Bill in 4D.
Yeah. When you get that many, but for me, it happened by mistake. I had two the same amount, and I didn't know which tenant was depositing the rent. So I had to come up with a way to figure it out. So.
No, I think it's clever. I think that's cool. So neat. All right, number three. What have you found are the biggest differences in investing in residential properties, like single family? I think they meant to multifamily.
Well, with the multifamily being under property management. I haven't been as involved with those tenants. I guess from my perspective, the biggest difference was the financing. And I was surprised because the amount of money that you're borrowing on the commercial side, I would have thought that would have been a lot more involved, and it wasn't. I mean, it was actually a lot easier. And even when you go to the closing table, it was probably less than half the paperwork that you're signing for that commercial deal versus the residential.
Okay. Yeah. Cool.
Right on. Why don't we go to last question. Do you feel you learn something new with every deal? And if so, what have you recently learned?
I like that question. That's a good question.
That's a good one. I'm glad I didn't come up with it.
Thank you, BP Forums. Yes. All right. Yeah. What have you learned recently?
I mean, I guess the most recent deal that I did was the multifamily. So, and this goes back, it's funny to hear this, but I went back and listened to your podcast number 4 from Frank, was it Gianelli?
Frank Gallinelli.
Yep. And so you guys were just getting started. And so I wanted to listen to something about commercial property. And so he goes back, he does a good job of talking about how value is determined on that commercial property. And so I never really had to do that with the residential. So learning the cap rates, learning how that value is, and that's what helped, I'm going to say, make me feel comfortable even doing that deal, realizing that, hey, this is calculated this way because of the net income. I could break these apart and sell them individually. And so there's some real value here that's really not being calculated into this number or a cushion. So anyway, so I guess that's the big thing that I learned on this most recent deal.
Cool.
Right on. That's great.
Should go back and listen to that one again. That's been, a couple of years since I heard that episode with Frank, but I remember that was a good one. So
it was.
And yeah, we were terrible.
We didn't know what we were doing.
Yeah. But,
I mean, we still don't know what we're doing.
Don't know what we're doing. Anyway, very cool. All right. Well, I love the fire round. So before we get out of here, let's shift gears one last time and hit up the
Famous Four.
All right. These are the same questions we ask every guest every week. So you've heard them 190 sometimes now, if not more. Number one. Steve, what is your favorite real estate book?
I'm going to say the Millionaire Real Estate Investor by Gary Keller.
Cool.
It motivated me to get started, and it just showed how many different ways you could be involved in real estate. Now, Rich Dad Poor Dad is a great one too, but that's got to be the number one. And then to help, if you want to do buy and hold, I mean, no joke. The book you and Heather did on managing rental property, there are some other good ones out there, but that is the best one that I've read. Landlording on Autopilot's pretty good, but really just setting up the systems. Those are the real estate books, I'd say.
Well, thank you. And Mike Butler's book, A Landlord on Autopilot, that helped us a ton when we were getting started. So
good. Cool. All right. Favorite business book.
This one is, I don't think I've ever heard anybody mention it, and I'm going to say it's kind of business related. It's actually called The Success Journey by John Maxwell. It's not necessarily a business book, but what it does is it's a book about, finding, knowing your purpose and growing to your maximum potential and sowing seeds to benefit others, that kind of thing. So what it's done for me is it helped me get on the path of learning and growing and continuing to push myself to be better. And so I'd say that was the one, just because it motivates me to do a lot of reading and listening and that kind of thing.
Cool. Right on. What about hobbies? What do you do for fun?
Well, I work full time, so real estate is kind of a hobby, even though I run it like a business. But my wife and I, we love to travel. Since we live here on the coast, we like to go stand up paddle boarding.
Nice.
Like to work out, play golf, that kind of thing.
Fun. That's awesome.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Last question of the day for me anyway. What do you believe sets apart successful real estate investors from all those who give up, they fail, or they just never get started?
First, I think you have to, I said it earlier, I think you have to learn, a continual learner. But then beyond that, you can't just learn it. You have to take action. So it's turning that knowledge into action. And, I heard somebody say this a long time ago, the difference between where you are now and where you'll be in 5 years is really the things that you put in your mind, the things you listen to, the things you watch, the things you read, and the people you associate with. So, if you want to grow or want to do something, that's the kind of thing you need to put in your mind, and you need to take action on that.
Love it.
Yeah, I love it.
That's really good. It's really good. All right. Lastly, where can people find out more about you? How do they link up with you?
Bigger Pockets. I don't have website or anything, but just look me up on Bigger Pockets.
Cool. And we will link to that in the show notes. You can find the link to Steve's profile and everything else we chatted about on the show notes at biggerpockets.com/show193. Steve, thank you very much. Really do appreciate having you on the show. Lots of luck to you going forward with the business. And we look forward to hearing about your future successes.
Well, thanks a lot for the website. You know, between it and Rhea, it is what helped me buy these properties and helped me learn what I've learned. So thank you for what you do.
Yeah. Perfect.
That's awesome.
Thanks, Steve.
All right. See you around, Steve.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right, guys. That was Steve Garner. Big thanks to Steve for coming on the show. You know, it looks like he's building a nice little business for himself, good little cash cow. And I love seeing how his philosophy has changed. I like his insight into management and things like that. I think he's doing a great job.
And I like that he's read my book. So, you know, win-win.
There you go. It's all about you.
It's all about
Ego
me.
Ego City.
That's all this is. Nah, so I like that he's managing his properties. You know, he's got the multifamily testing out property management, which, you know, is always something that you want to test out. I mean, you don't have to have property management. You can, and it's something that's going to be different for every person, but it's kind of cool. He's testing that out, and we'll see.
Hey,
maybe we'll have him back. Yeah.
Hey, when was the last time you called somebody who had a for rent sign and asked them if they wanted to sell?
Man, it's been a while. Man, I stopped hustling as hard as I used to. You know, I'm going to do that. When's the last time you did it?
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Never.
Yeah. It's been a little while.
No, it's a great idea. I love it. And yeah, man, Steve's doing good things. Cool. Well, listen, next week, I think we've got a little different show. I think we're going to have a bit of a guest host.
For the first time in 193 shows, I will not be here on the Bigger Pockets podcast.
No. I don't remember what show he was on, but my co-host will be Dave Meyer.
Yeah.
Works here at Bigger Pockets, and he was one of our guests. But yeah, it'll be fun. It's going to be a lot of fun, you know, actually having a adult conversation, and, you know, allowing our listeners to you know, speak to a mature, you know, listen to mature hosts.
I'm going
to
be hanging out with like 900 financial bloggers out there at the FinCon conference. So
awesome.
That's where I'll be. You'll be awesome. Hanging out here on the podcast in terrible, cold, gross Denver, Colorado.
Oh, yeah.
Is it cold and gross? I don't know.
No, it's amazing. What are you talking about?
Yeah, it's Denver. It's always cool. Nice.
Guys, right. This is show, 193 of the Bigger Pockets podcast. Definitely make sure to check out the show notes at biggerpockets.com/show193. If you haven't left us a rating review, please do that today on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever else you are listening. And otherwise, jump on Bigger Pockets. Get in there. Get involved, get active in the community. I say it every show because it makes a difference. Like when people go and do that, they're like, oh my God, why didn't I do this sooner?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I agree.
Get out there and make it happen. With that, I'm Josh Dorkin, signing off.
You're listening to Bigger Pockets Radio, simplifying real estate for investors large and small. If you're here looking to learn about real estate investing without all the hype, you're in the right place. Be sure to join the millions of others who have benefited from BiggerPockets.com, your home for real estate investing online.
There's a reason small multifamily investing is so popular in the Bigger Pockets community. With just a 3.5% down payment, you can own up to 4 different units. Think about it. If you house hack and live in one of the units, you still have 3 different groups of tenants helping you pay down your mortgage every month, 4 kitchens and bathrooms you could renovate to increase your property value, 4 different Airbnbs, medium-term rentals, or other rental strategies that you can try in one property, all in just one transaction. Of course, the question is, where do you find a small multifamily property that you can actually afford? Which market and which deals are best for you? Once you close, how do you manage it, optimize it, keep scaling, and living your life without being tied down to 4 leaky toilets or 4 fussy tenants? All great questions, my friends. All to be answered in the upcoming Small Multifamily Bootcamp with Chris Lopez and Leka Devatha. So if you're serious about growing your portfolio with this highly efficient strategy, head to biggerpockets.com/four, F-O-U-R, today and join us in the Small Multifamily Bootcamp. See you there.
The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only.
Past performance is not indicative of future results, and all hosts and participant opinions are their own.
Investment in any asset, real estate included, involves risk. Use your best judgment and consult with qualified advisors before investing. Only risk capital you can afford to lose.
Bigger Pockets LLC disclaims all liability for direct, indirect, consequential, or other damages arising from reliance upon information presented in this podcast.